Nancy Scott presented her intellectual autobiography as the second talk in a series entitled Coming to Truth on January 16, 2008 at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to talk about my relationship with truth. I've had a relationship with truth for a long time, and I kind of think of it that way because we haven't always gotten along, but we've had to try to work things out. Me and truth, and still working that out. So that's a kind of just an opening frame. I did grow up in a time and place where I don't think the same questioning that is current these days was necessarily part of my particular struggle, and that is I don't think I ever doubted that truth existed. I always believed that truth existed in some way. However, the pluralism of society as it's grown, I think, has shifted that some. I definitely grew up in that kind of milieu that raised the question of, even though I didn't question whether there was truth, I definitely questioned whose version was true. And so that was certainly a part of my... Do you guys want to open the door? Can you hear me out there? I thought they could. You're welcome to come in or sit out in the back or whatever. So, but one thing that I've learned over time is that that while there are a lot of different versions of what's true, I guess I'm just starting with saying that I never really questioned that there was truth, but I often questioned which truth was true, or like whose version, whose story should I buy. But I always felt like there was probably going to be one that was better than another, that, you know, they weren't all equal. I think I kind of had that assumption going into it. So, and I'm going to just kind of tell a little bit of my background and my story and maybe make a few little snippets along the way of, so this is kind of, you know, pretty open here. I don't know where it's going to go, but anyway, I do kind of know, but we'll see how it goes. So my relationship with truth started, I think, when I was probably 4 or 5 years old. I remember lying out on the grass of my parents' front yard, looking up at the sky and watching the clouds. And you know, when you're a kid and you make shapes out of clouds, and I was making shapes out of the clouds and looking at, you know, puffy dinosaurs going by and just really enjoying that and thinking about that. And I just remember having this awareness that something made those clouds, something made that sky. And it was one of those days where I think I probably came in to my mother and said, "Mommy, who made the sky?" You know, something like that. And she said, "God." "God did." I said, "Okay, that works." And so I didn't actually grow up in a Christian home. My parents were nominally Christian. We weren't Buddhist or Hindu. We were Christian in that sense. But we went to church on Easter and Christmas and that sort of thing. We didn't really do much beyond that. But when I asked questions like that, my mother said, "God." And I said, "Okay." And then my family went through a number of different difficult experiences. And out of those, my mother began a search for her own understanding of truth and reality, and that search took us to a number of different churches. She went on quite a search, very broad. She looked into a lot of different avenues, a lot of different possibilities before taking me along with her one day to a Bible church in Dallas, Texas, was where we were living at the time. And I remember the day sitting there. I mean, it must have been maybe 10 years old. I wasn't very old. But I remember the guy getting up there and talking about the Bible and talking about the gospel and talking about Jesus dying for my sins and how that needed to happen. And I just remember sitting there thinking, that's so great. I definitely needed that to happen. I already knew that I was a rebel on some level. I mean, I couldn't keep my own rules, and I was a very compliant kid, and so whenever I broke the rules, it was a big deal to me. But I knew that I was a rule breaker. And so when I heard that message, I just went, I'm in. And I did what they told me to do, which was to say a prayer and accept Christ as my Savior and take care of that right then and there. So they didn't do altar calls, so I didn't have to do that, thankfully. But I was sitting right there taking it in, and I don't know, I was probably 9 or 10. So, and my mother became a Christian about that same time. And so she and I began attending this Bible church and getting very involved in that. So I was then at that point we joined the Christian culture, I think, in kind of a fuller way. Now my father and my brother did not, so it was my mom and I that did this, and they were over there doing something else. So by the time I got to high school, I was very involved in trying to understand what the Bible had to say. I saw it as something that was God's word to me, and that it had the answers that I needed. And I definitely had the sense of it was the source book for life and truth and reality and that sort of thing, although I didn't really know what to do with it. I was a Bible student. I was it was an intellectual crowd I was in, because the church we went to was staffed by seminary professors from Dallas Seminary. And so, I did Greek classes in my 10th grade year and stuff like that. And so it was very heady in that sense. But it also started me off with a real respect for an intellectual and coherent sort of putting together of what's true, that it was a serious project on some level. And I think that was a good beginning in a lot of ways. But by the time our family had to move to Louisiana from Texas, and so my last 2 years were spent in high school in Louisiana, and we didn't have a church there that was anything like that. And so we were, I in particular became kind of a super Christian missionary type kid in my last 2 years of high school, leading Bible studies and doing different things and that sort of thing. Well, then I got to know some people who had really different views and who really challenged me. And by the time I was a senior, toward the end of my senior year, I was really starting to question whether or not I knew what in the world I was talking about, because maybe I just believed this because, you know, back when I was a little kid, it sounded good to me. I was only 9 or 10 years old, and what do I know? And I had this one friend of mine in particular who raised some really interesting questions to me, like, well, how do you know that's true? And how do you know there's a God? What do you make? Maybe there's not. You know, what if there's not? What if I don't think there is? You know, he'd say things like that. And I was just like, really? Wow, I never thought of that. But it's really started sinking into me, like, these were important questions, and they were questions that I couldn't really answer very well, and I needed to. I needed to understand that for myself. And so I went to my high school youth group leader, who was maybe just probably a few years older than myself, maybe just out of college, and I told her in this kind of state of panic, how do I know that there's a God? I have this burning question. How do I know that there's a God? I need to understand why I believe what I believe. And her answer to me was not satisfying. Her answer to me was, everybody has doubts. Don't worry about it. Take an aspirin. You'll feel better in the morning. And so I went to a couple of other people, and I got a similar response. I kind of got the message pretty quickly that, you know, don't ask those questions. You're kind of being a troublemaker. I think Earl said something about that last time about his Sunday school class, that he got kicked out because he asked too many questions. I didn't ever get kicked out because I didn't ask them during class, but I was making a nuisance of myself. And by the time I was, I don't know, not too long after that, I thought, well, I guess I'm not supposed to ask that. Never mind, you know. But it didn't satisfy me, and I kept thinking about it, and I kept wondering what was really... It seemed to me like if I'm laying on the grass as a 5-year-old and thinking, God did that, then he could probably defend himself or you know, answer something if I had questions about it. So it didn't really fit for me. But anyway, I kind of went on a bit. I want to back up for a minute and say that I'm going to tell this story in kind of two separate layers, because one of the layers is this intellectual journey. So it's about kind of what I decided was true, and it can sound like it was an intellectual journey, and it was. But there was also another layer of this journey going on, and that was my relationship to my own life, my hurts, my disappointments, what I wanted out of life, what I wasn't getting out of life. And on that level, I was wrestling with God in a way that I was never conscious of on a certain level. I would have never at that time been able to say, I'm going to decide what I believe based on this experience of being disappointed with God. I'm going to actually decide to be an atheist because God has disappointed me. So I could not have said that. But looking back now, I see the layers of that happening. And so, kind of jumped forward there. I did become an atheist. I went on to asking some of these questions that were never answered very well. I went to college, became a biology major, and the people I met in biology were very happy to talk to me about those questions. And they really liked those questions, and they had really good answers. Their answer was, there isn't one. And it was compelling to me. It was actually quite compelling to me. And one of the things that was compelling about it was that they were willing to talk about it. And the people I'd met in Christianity really weren't. So I thought, well, I think this is where the intellectual integrity is, actually. And so I converted. And I literally, like, said that. I said, I have now converted to atheism. And I would sign forms that asked for religious preference or anything like that. I'd write biologist. You know, that was my religion. And so that was very much, it was a compelling worldview to me. I began studying evolution and evolutionary processes and in biology. And I built a worldview that was very, what I thought was very coherent. And my journey was toward truth. My commitment was toward truth. The reason I left Christianity was because I was interested in truth. And so that was, again, an intellectual decision on one level. On another level, a whole bunch of other things were going on that I'll get to also. Okay, so let me see how I'm doing in relation to what I thought I was going to be talking about. Okay, so there was another layer happening in my life, and that was that my family was went through some very difficult times when I was a small child. I had a lot of you have heard this story, but I had an older brother who was diagnosed with leukemia and who died about 2.5 years later. And I was about 2.5 when he died. He was 8. My other brother was about 5 at that time. And my mother, who at the time, remember, was not a Christian, had enough Christian. Like I said, she was a nominal Christian. She believed that God put the sky there, but she didn't have any real understanding of who God was. And her first response to that event in her life was, God is punishing me for something that I have no idea what. And she really spiraled at that point into not only searching through a lot of different things to make sense out of this experience in her life, but also kind of a, she didn't get a lot of good help with that process. This was the 1950s. You didn't talk about hard things. It was off the table. It was okay. Everything was fine. Don't talk about it. And so my mother descended into a very deep depression. And in the course of that depression for her, she at different times was very unavailable to me as a child and to my brother and I. And so there were times in my young childhood where I was very afraid a lot for my mother's safety. I really wondered if she would take her life, and I felt very compelled to make sure she did not do that. And so I worked really hard at being a good kid, and I worked really hard at checking the bedroom door and making sure she was still okay. And so there was a time when I decided that I was so afraid of that, that I didn't know where else to go. So I found a Bible somewhere in our family house. I don't know what it was doing there because it wasn't used much. But I thought, if that's God's book, then God is going to have to keep my mother safe. And I must have been, again, probably 9 years old. It probably wasn't too long before, or maybe close to that time when we started going to churches. And I went into my bedroom, and I got down on my knees. And I thought, because somebody, I'd seen that in a movie, I guess, or something. But I opened the Bible and just started reading it and praying and asking God to please not let my mother hurt herself. And I made him a promise that I would do anything he asked me if he would do that. So it was a very powerful experience for me. I was making a deal with God. And so I set about to be the best kid I could and to get the best grades and to not be a problem. And that was me keeping my promise. And as long as I did that, my mom was going to be okay. So that worked out. Interestingly enough, it seemed to work out. Shortly after that, we found this church. We became Christians. My mother got better. So, and the reason I tell that story is that what it set up for me was an understanding of God, that if I could make a deal with him, my life would go okay. And it kind of worked that way. So it kind of taught me that, like, I can get it right, and I got to get it right. And if I can get it right, then everything's going to be okay. And I was really going to work on that. And I did okay for a while. I did pretty well until I got to college and decided that this whole God thing wasn't so great. But that set me up. The reason I'm telling that is that that set me up to have a belief that if I get it right, my life will go okay. So I have just gotten over a cold, and so my throat is going to be a little bit iffy. So I hope it holds up. I think it might. But okay, so next part of the story. Okay, so as you might imagine, there was a man involved. And at a certain point in my high school and early college years, there was a particular man involved who who was one of the friends who was raising questions for me about who God was, and was helping me think through and ask the question about whether or not I had good reasons to believe in God. Well, it just so happened that we fell in love, and we were very intensely involved and just knew we were going to always be together. And then I went to the Bible camp that I go to and discovered that he didn't really fit the mold for being the right kind of Christian for me to think about marrying. And so here was my tension. If you can understand this, it was like my rule-keeping that's going to make my life go okay is all of a sudden colliding with this person that I'm in love with who I'm breaking the rules with, because he doesn't fit the mold. And so I had to make a decision about what I was going to do with that. And my decision was that I better keep the rules. And so I broke up with him because he didn't fit the mold. And the reason I'm kind of, this is, you know, kind of a personal layer of the story, obviously, but what I want to illustrate with it is that this is going on underneath the intellectual process of deciding. So all this time I'm thinking, and so who is God anyway? Well, of course I'm thinking that because I'm hanging out with this person who's asking that all the time. And I'm really compelled to answer that. And then it starts to matter whether or not I can be with him and think about a future with him and this kind of thing. And so then I said no to that, broke up. It was devastating to both of us in many ways. And in looking back on it, I think that what I believed at the time was that if I do it right, God's going to give me what I need. Because that's the rule that I'd learned. Does that make sense? So it's like, oh, this is the bargain. So I think that when I broke up with him, I never thought that meant we weren't going to be together. I thought that was my way of obeying God so that he would give it to me. And that that would make him become a Christian, and then we could be together. So it was a very kind of quid pro quo sort of arrangement that I developed with God. And so in the end, as I look back on my conversion to atheism, it wasn't just about the biologists having a better answer. It was about me being really disappointed that the rule didn't work. Because it didn't work. He didn't become a Christian. We didn't get back together. We broke each other's hearts and moved on. And it was devastating. And within about 2 years of that was when I became an atheist. So I think they're connected. Like I said, I couldn't have said that at the time. I would not have said that at the time. At the time, I would have said, Christianity doesn't work. It doesn't work. I'm out of here. But over time, what I've learned is that there are layers. So our truth-seeking is not always just intellectual. And my sense is that even though I'm supposed to be telling more of an intellectual story about my relationship with truth, I think it's more complicated than that. Because we are more complicated. We're very complex creatures, and we have a lot of different things going on underneath the surface. And our lives are about working all that through and figuring out what we believe in the context of our experiences. And so this is the journey that we embark upon as we move toward truth. Okay. So, catching up with me at age about, I guess I was about 21 when I officially became an atheist. And I continued in my atheism for a number of years. I pursued a degree in zoology, and then I pursued a master's degree in biology, and then I took a position as a fish biologist, as an aquatic ecology research associate, and I did field work, and I trolled the Mississippi River, and this was all in Louisiana, so got to know the rivers really well and worked on rivers and loved my work, would mess about in boats and think, this is what we are meant to do. Is mess about in boats, and I was getting paid for it, and I loved it. I was very during that period. I was still very much, I would say, and even at the time, I would have said, I am pursuing truth. I am believing what I believe very consciously and very deliberately, and it makes sense. And I was building a worldview that had to do with the biology things that I knew, and it had to do with what I knew out of my experience, and I was involved in different relationships that were also forming my beliefs and reinforcing them, and friendships and all that kind of thing. So I was a very contented atheist for a number of years. And then what happened took me by tremendous surprise when I had a coworker in my lab at LSU who was a Christian, and one of the kind of atheist I was, I have to confess, is the kind that used to really like to give Christians a bad time because I had some feelings about Christianity. Christianity was not my friend. And so, as you can imagine, through all these experiences. And so I really enjoyed giving him a bad time. And we kind of ganged up on him. I mean, everybody in the lab enjoyed giving him a bad time. And he kind of asked for it in some ways. But he was a nice enough guy, but the poor guy didn't stand a chance with us. So we battered him pretty badly at times because we were right, you know, in the end. We were right. So, and we were really self-righteous about that a lot of times. So anyway, one summer, Steve and I ended up on a field crew together, and we were in, we had a truck that was pulling, we all pull boats and, work on, we were coming down the Mississippi River over several weeks, and we were on a crew together, and we were in one truck together, and so he and I traveled together quite a bit, and we would have these conversations, and I would kind of try to pin him to, something that was ridiculous about what he believed. And I did that quite often, and I often won, I have to say. I mean, he didn't do very well with it at times, but poor guy. But with this one conversation we had, he was talking about something out of the Bible that said something, and I'm thinking, I used to study the Bible, and I don't think it says that. And I think you're wrong about that. And I'm thinking, I'm going to prove it. So I went home that weekend. We came back for weekends every now and then. And so when I got home that weekend, I thought, I know there's a Bible in this house somewhere. I don't know where. But I found a Bible, and I thought, I'm going to prove him wrong. And I pulled out that Bible, and I couldn't have been more shocked to spend the next 3 hours reading this Bible and going, oh. I don't know if I'm supposed to censor this, but my response was, I'll censor it. Crap. I think this might be true. Like, oh no. I am not happy about that. And what happened was I don't even know why I picked what I picked, but I ended up reading the Gospel of Matthew. And there were all these curious little references in it to what Isaiah the prophet had said. And then there were notes in the margin that had a reference that could take you back to Isaiah. And so then I'd like go back and be like, where's Isaiah? What does Isaiah have to do? And I'd read this and like kind of match what it was saying. And then I'd go back and just, read more and say, so then this was done so that what was fulfilled by Isaiah the prophet. And I'm like, Isaiah. So like going back. And I did this for several hours, seriously, and just was like, whoa. And what hit me was, because I also then looked into the front of the Bible that told when all these books were written and all that, and it was like, wow, these were written like 500-600 years apart, these two books. That is a seriously well-done conspiracy. I mean, something has to account for this, and I'm thinking, what if this is true? I mean, I don't think they could pull that off, a 500-year conspiracy. I think that would be pretty difficult. And so I was really upset about that. And so I kind of just, and I just kept reading it and thinking, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? Because remember, this whole time, I'm interested in truth. I mean, truth is important to me, and I believed my atheism out of my commitment to truth. And so here I am really struggling, and so I said to God right then and there, I said, I don't want to be a Christian, but if this is true, I'm in. And I don't want to do Christianity, but you'll have to change me. Because it might be that I need to do that, and I don't want to do it, and I'm not changing me, you're going to have to change me. Kind of what I said to him. Pretty presumptuous after all, but, taking on the God of the universe and telling him what for, but that was me. And so I kind of told him what for, and I said, I'm not changing me, you'll have to change me. So that started my being dragged, kicking and screaming, as C.S. Lewis once said, into Christianity. And what struck me at that moment that was very profound to me and that has continued to be very profound to me is that... oh, sorry. is that I was a student of biology, and here I am reading this Bible. And I think I did go back and read Genesis, too, because I'm just thinking, oh, there's something about, evolution in here, right? But that was a joke. But anyway. but what struck me that was very profound was that, okay, what I know stuff about evolution and about biology, And if this Bible that I'm running into now I think is actually true, then somehow or another they're going to have to meet. They're going to have to bear each other out. And because truth, you know, if it's true, it's true. And so that actually became a very immediate and serious commitment for myself, is that I wanted to follow truth wherever it took me, because it had to match. And I was thinking, it didn't just have to match for me. I was just thinking, it has to match, right? I mean, wouldn't truth have to match? If it's true, it's going to fit together somehow. And so I just thought that that must be true. And so I thought, I'm going to work on that. I'm going to work on that. So that's what I set about doing, in a way. And from there, I'll shorten the story a bit, but I went from there to kind of sneaking in to churches every now and then, and because I really didn't think they'd want me there. And I didn't have the right politics, for one thing. But and this was during the Reagan years. And so I was very hesitant to, and I was also very hesitant to get involved with Christianity again, quite honestly. I was very gun-shy, because I felt that it had been very hurtful to me in my early experience with it. So that set me on a course of trying to decide, how could I make sense out of my life and Christianity? And how can I work those things through? And so within a year or two of that, I left Louisiana. I moved to the Carolinas for a few years and worked at a different university. Now, keep in mind that my commitment was that these are going to match. But in my experience of working as a biologist at another university, and then finally over time getting involved in a church that I felt really good about and felt committed to, my worlds became further and further apart. They kind of disintegrated. And so I would go to work over here and do my biology stuff out of my naturalistic worldview that I knew well. But I also knew that now I believed Christianity, and so I would go over here and study the Bible and have fellowship with people and talk about faith and our understanding of God that was very profound and meaningful to me. And so these worlds had nothing in common with each other. And so over time, over maybe just 3 or 4 years, that I was like more and more living in these two very separate worlds. And it occurred to me that I thought I was going to like work this out so that they've met somehow. But it wasn't happening. And that's about the time me and you guys at Gutenberg hear us, you know, all talk about our relationship with Francis Schaeffer and his writings. And that was the moment that someone handed me a Francis Schaeffer book. And that moment was really life-saving to me. Because here was a man who had done what I was saying, I know this can work. I know this can be done, but I don't know how to do it. And apparently nobody else is interested in doing that. And then I read The God Who Is There and go, oh my gosh, he's doing what I was talking about. And so I started reading everything I could get my hands on by Francis Schaeffer, and I read a lot of other people too, but I really started pursuing that. And so anyway, within a few years, I then landed here at McKenzie Study Center at the time. This is before Gutenberg started. And again, had the experience of having never really found in the Christian community a place where that pursuit was really very encouraged or really pursued very much. I was starting to get back into the pattern of, I got to get it right somehow. I'm going to have to do this right somehow. Maybe I'm supposed to go be a missionary. Maybe that's how you get it right. Because if you're really serious about being a Christian, what do? You go be a missionary, right? And so I left the Carolinas to come here to study, to join Wycliffe Bible Translators, and that's actually how I landed here and met I met Wes and Carol that summer, and a long time ago now. So I just came for the summer, and that'll be 19 years ago this summer. So, but what kept me here at the time was, again, that sense of, oh my gosh, I think these are people who are doing this thing that I'd wanted to do, which was bring these two worlds together somehow and make a coherent picture out of Christianity that fit also with my experience. And so that became very powerful to me and very meaningful to me. So, okay. How are you guys doing? How are you holding up? Okay. Any thoughts or questions to just interrupt me for a minute?
On the timeline a little bit, when you talked about your last depression, and you said you were, you said something about 2.5 and then you skipped to 9, so I was just wondering,
right.
Your brother died, and then right after that, you think she kind of started her depression, but the checking on the door thing started when you were, like, how old?
I was probably 8. Okay. It was probably for a couple of years, 8 to 10, about. Sure. She asked me to clarify the timeline between when my brother died and when my mother entered her depression and how and when I started checking the door. Yeah. And I'd say she was depressed sooner than that. But I became conscious of it and aware of it and worried about it when I was about 8, I think. And I might be early on the church experience. I think that might have been more like 10 or 11 when we finally went to that church. That's a little rusty to me. Because I think it was a couple years that that was that process of being worried about her and, you know.
And did you feel like there was someone in your family that was kind of worried? And that's why there was so much burden on you or your dad?
Yeah, I think so. My dad traveled a lot, so he wasn't there very much. He traveled for his work. And so he was just kind of absent. When he was there, he seemed to not be too worried about it. But he wasn't there to know what to worry about, is how I felt. It's like if he was here more, he'd be worried. But I also didn't have a sense of being able to talk about that or say, is anybody else worried? You know, I mean, I think it's a huge gift we can give our kids to give them permission to ask questions, to struggle, to be open. Because that locking down, I think, was a part of the difficulty for me, was that I wasn't allowed. It was like I felt like that you just didn't do that. You know, that was against the rules to do that. So.
When you decided to convert to atheism, how was your mother feeling about this? Was she trying to stay with Christianity, or had your family?
The question was, how did my mother respond when I converted to Christianity? And, or converted, I'm sorry, yeah, wrong conversion. How did she respond when I converted to atheism, right? I'm not sure I made a proclamation to her exactly, although she did know it fairly quickly that I was no longer doing Christianity. My mother was actually quite insightful, and one of the things she said to me early on in that process was, and actually it was probably before I converted to atheism, actually, but I was heading in that direction. She said, "You're mad about that boy. You're mad at God, and you better get over that." I was like, "That is not it. Are you crazy? That is so not it." And she was so dead on, you know, she was so dead on. But I couldn't hear it, and so I went on from there. But she was quite concerned about me, and she was someone who, together with her band of women friends, never stopped praying for me, and would tell me that every now and then, and it would really tick me off. Yeah, I pretty much shut her down after that. It was like, don't even ask me about that stuff, would you? You know. So, but she kept praying. So she quit telling me about it eventually, but. But she kept praying. So. Mothers are good at that.
Was what happened with your brother, was that in your mom, was that kind of what prompted you to get into therapy and psychology?
Yeah, I think so. By the time I was, after I became a Christian again, and within a couple of years of that, I started my own therapy for looking at that issue, because I was just aware of some of the, I had not responded well to a lot of things, really, in my life, and they were taking a toll. And so I went into my own therapy, and what I discovered then, I didn't expect to discover this when I went into therapy, but the first therapist I went to see, the first thing he had me do was do a timeline of my early life. I was like, okay. But I went through photographs, and I found all these photographs of my brother, who was, you know, 6 years older than me. In every photograph that I found, he either had his arm around me or was holding my hand, or, you know, he was very connected to me. And that was very powerful to me, because it helped me realize that that was a very significant relationship in my life that had been just disappeared. And I found out in the course of that that they hadn't actually, because it was 1958, seriously, the 50s were dark. They might have been clean with fun gadgets, but they were dark, emotional days. And they basically believed that it was the right thing to do to not tell the children that he had died. So they didn't tell me that he had died. Yeah. Now, that isn't to say that that we didn't know it in my family that he had died. I knew that. But we didn't talk about it. Ever. Yeah. So it was very dysfunctional. But it was out of the best of intentions. I mean, it was really thought to be the way to do it. So.
Why was it that you studied biology?
Why was it?
Yeah.
When I moved from Texas to Louisiana, we had lived in a big urban, well, in Dallas, and I used to go to this stream on my bicycle and sit and watch the water. And years later, I found out it was a drainage ditch. It was very sad. But I moved to Louisiana and lived two blocks from the Chifuncta River with cypress knees this high and just incredible wildlife, birds, and there was a walk from my house. There were no houses in between us and this two-block walk to the river. And I would walk down to this boathouse and sit down there and watch the birds. And I fell in love. I fell in love with the river and with the wildlife and fell in love with biology. So it was birds mostly. I went to study birds and I ended up studying fish. But field biology was definitely a love and still is. I mean, I miss that. Sometimes still, you know, and I think, oh, I miss boats, mostly. I miss messing about on boats. And I need one in my life. I need one in my life again. So I'm working on that. But yeah. So. Any other clarifications?
Uh-huh. Can you expand a little bit more about the book that God was there and how that began to reconcile the two?
Sure, sure. He asked if I could expand on the God who is there and the impact that that had and how it connected the two worlds. I don't think it did a lot to actually do the connecting, but what it told me was that it was a reasonable project. So it told me that it was a good thing to want in that sense. And so, and I think that the reason it told me that was that in that book, you know, I haven't read it in a long time now. I've read it a couple times, but has a trilogy, kind of the God who is there, the escape from reason, and then he is there and he's not silent. Those were kind of his early kind of trilogy books. And I think he does kind of his normal sort of swashbuckling history of ideas sort of thing. And because of that, what it told me, because I had never really thought about history of ideas or that kind of idea, and so when I saw the progression of ideas, it was very helpful to me to understand that, for example, the reason I was eager to believe a naturalistic worldview was because I live in a time when that's a paradigm that is available to me, and that that has a context, you know, that came through a march of ideas that put me in a time and place where that was more plausible than it would have been 100 years earlier, say. And so that got me thinking about truth and how truth works. And, oh, the other thing that he would talk about is how truth works to, that the way you discover truth is to follow it to its logical conclusion and to see if it fits with experience and reality. And that really rang some bells for me. Like, no, now that sounds like something I can do. Because if I think something's true, if I follow it, it will either take me toward a better understanding of something, or else it's going to fail. But that's going to be my signpost. And so I think that was very important to me to think about, oh, so you can discover truth. It kind of helped me know. And the other thing that Schaefer was very good at and a bit famous for was integrating. He would say that Christ is the Lord of all of life. And so that was that integrating piece. Like, okay, if God is the God of the universe, and if Jesus Christ is Lord of all of life, then he's Lord of my biology career too. He's the Lord of whatever pursuit I do. And it fits. And he's not opposed to that. It's not like I'm supposed to not do that because God isn't in that. That was another really powerful thing that Schaefer gave to me. So...
Yeah, I don't know if this is jumping ahead too much, but I'm just curious in terms of your views now as a Christian
mm-hmm.
and of Christianity, if they're less orthodox views having gone through this process, and I just mm-hmm. curious about some of your views on, like, say, evolution or
okay,
scripture,
yeah,
inerrancy and stuff like that. I don't know
right.
what different stuff you get into,
mm-hmm.
but I'm just sort of
okay.
curious about hearing the story. Talking about interesting journey,
right.
there,
right.
Where your faith would be at in terms of some of those
yeah.
questions.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I wanted to say that I think this is a great segue for is that I think that because, and I alluded to this a little bit in the beginning, but because of how pluralistic our society is now, it's very clear to us that there are a whole lot of options out there for deciding what's true. And we don't have one, meta-narrative, one big story that we all kind of agree on. There's all kind. I mean, we could go into every individual in this room and learn nuances of, like, how we understand truth. And I think Earl did a really great job of talking about sort of that, just the vicissitudes of human knowledge in that sense. It's really different, and it changes over time. But I think that because of the pluralism that we live in and that we breathe in every minute of every day, I think it takes harder work for us to decide what's true, where it could have been more assumed at some point in history, I think. Like, it wouldn't have been as hard, it wouldn't have been going against the grain, for example, to decide that the Bible is true. It wouldn't have been a question, even, a couple hundred years ago. So I think that's significant. And I think what that does for us is it makes it harder work. And so I think it's really important work. I don't think it's... I think having a coherent understanding of the universe and the reality that God has created and who God is and what the gospel is, I think is incredibly helpful in living life. It's very practical knowledge to have just a coherent worldview. We live in a very incoherent time and place. and so much so now that incoherency is considered to be our only option. Coherency isn't even really on the table anymore in some very big ways. But I think we were made for coherency, and I think truth is coherent. And so I guess all I'm saying is it's harder work now, but I think it's a really, really good project to do. And so that is one of the projects I had to take on, and it was hard work because there are a lot of different ideas to sift through out there. But I did go through a process of, in my early years here with the study center, I spent a lot of time, I did begin a study of the history of ideas in greater depth, and I also looked into different ideas and different authors' perspectives on evolution and creation, and I got involved in reading a lot of things about creation science and kind of delved into that area to try to see if I thought that fit with what I knew out of biology that I'd studied. And over time, I would say I'm probably unorthodox in a lot of ways, but I think that putting together the historical picture of the origins of the created world are, it's a difficult thing to put together because it's not really a history that we have an account of in a, we have accounts that tell us that God did it, but I don't know that the purpose of those accounts was necessarily to help us understand when reptiles emerged, for example. And so that's kind of how I would say it. It's like, I think the point of the accounts is to really help us know that God created And that's clear to me. And I think there's really good work being done by a lot of different people in some of the design work that's being done, intelligent design, that kind of thing. But I'm much more willing now. In fact, this is kind of getting ahead too, but from where I started in my journey to understanding, okay, truth is coherent and I can put it together. I feel like I did that in a lot of ways. I worked really hard for a number of years to do that, and that was an actual project, you know, that was very important to me. And then I kind of got to a place where I think I kind of get it. I think it makes sense. I think I have a coherent picture that's workable. And it's not like I think I know a lot of stuff. In fact, anybody who's, you know, as we get older, we'll just all tell you that we know less and less. Because, I mean, the older I get, the less I feel like I know, because I understand the limitations of my knowledge better, and I also understand that this other layer that I started talking about, the one where I'm either fighting with God or surrendering to God, that's ultimately the soul issue. And so even as I think putting together a coherent worldview is a wonderful project, I wouldn't call it an essential project. In that way, I don't think we all need to be intellectuals. I don't think we all need to be scholars. But I'm grateful to the people who God has called to be scholars. And I'm grateful to their help in helping me understand some things that have helped me feel more settled and grounded and coherent in my picture of the world. It's been very helpful in living life, and it continues to be. So I'm very grateful for that. But I do think that pursuing truth and discovering truth with certainty are two very different things. And pursuing truth on this other level, what I was going to shift into talking about, if that's okay. Anybody else have a I was going to talk a little bit about another relationship that I feel like was really important for me to put together, and that's why I brought the whiteboard. I was going to draw a diagram, but I don't know if I'm going to do that or not, but my mic still. And that is a time when I had to put together, because of my early experiences and then my growing interest in emotional health, I had to work with, what's the relationship then with intellectual truth and emotional truth and subject, like inwardness, like whether or not I'm open to God, whether or not I'm interested in what he's doing, and even whether or not when it comes right down to it, if he says, like he did with me, you don't get to have that, what are you going to do with that? It's huge, because I can cloak that in, and this is what I did, see, I cloaked it in, Christianity doesn't hold up. It's not true. I don't believe it anymore. I'm going to be an atheist. And what was really going on the inside was, how dare you, God? You have failed the deal that we made a long time ago. You said if I would do it this way, you would do it that way. I heard you say that. Well, you know what? Being a creature is a very vulnerable place to be. Being a creature is very difficult, and the God of the universe is not really that interested in our comfort. And so when it comes right down to it, for God to take away something that we have the sense of is life itself to me, that is going to raise this enormous question of, what am I going to do with that? And it could be that it's the most, I would say it is the most important question any of us will ever face. Because every single one of us has something that God does that with us with. And I think that's no accident. I think that it's very much a part of his commitment to revealing who he is and who we are and what faith is. And that's the soul level. So I also had to go through a process of discovering then, okay, so how do these two levels work together? And there's inwardness, but then there's also emotional health, and there's emotional well-being, there's emotional truth. There's the understanding that I had to come to while I'm working through how my biology fits with my Christianity, which was a cognitive sort of project. That was an intellectual, very important intellectual process of discovery for me, and it took a lot of work. At the same time, this time, I'm also going through this process with therapy and with, you know, different things, and beginning to recognize how impactful the emotional beliefs that I carry with me are. And that I have to decide whether those are true. And I got to work with that. I got to figure out, what do I really believe about reality? And so one of those emotional beliefs then, you can imagine, is if I don't get it right, something bad is going to happen. So that was not a conscious belief for me, but it was a very powerful belief, and it directed me to become an overachiever, a perfectionist, all kinds of things. Not to mention somebody who was very committed to, the good side is, very committed to trying to figure out what's right. You know, that's a good thing to do. But to understand it as, if I don't do that, my life isn't, it was a matter of life and death to me with my mother, the thing with my mother. It was huge. And so it set me up to have this belief that if I don't get it right, I'm in big trouble. And so that's an emotional belief that then I go about getting it right all the time. And I don't even know that I'm believing emotionally that if I don't get it right, then I'm in big trouble. but I'm just going to spin until I get it right, until I wear out. And what happened to me was I wore out. I just kind of started to crash. Like, I can't get it right anymore. And besides that, I wasn't getting it right. And I knew that. And I kept seeing ways that I wasn't getting it right. And it was like, that's when it started to occur to me that I have this belief, you know, that is maybe not accurate. And I have to work with that. But to try to shift that belief requires a willingness to enter into some very vulnerable places in ourselves and to really expose ourselves to our own fears, to our own failures, to our griefs, to the side of the emotional spectrum that as a culture we have decided is not necessary. And so as a child of the 50s, I learned that well. And so kind of pushing away anything that was negative, like grief or sadness or fear, is a very good recipe for deteriorating emotional health. And so I started getting really interested in that process. And so this was the little picture I was going to draw. And Earl touched on this a little bit, but I thought I'd add, I don't remember exactly now where he was going with it, but he was talking about rationality and truth being rational, I think. And here's how I've begun to put it together, how I've tended to put it together. So we have rationality, and that's where I think Earl talked about the law of non-contradiction. It's a fancy word for a fancy phrase that Schaefer uses for basically saying that that reality is logical, that this board cannot both be here and not be here at the same time. That's A cannot be non-A. Right? Is that right? Okay. I haven't done this in a while. So anyway, so this is like this principle of, if you will, as a part of God who created this reality. And if, you know, kind of like, can God make a rock big enough that he can't lift it? It's one of those, no, he can't. Okay? Because that's just stupid. But because he created a rational universe, and that's irrational. So irrational would be not that. Okay, so, and here's where it gets a little personal for me, because growing up as a woman, I was often told that I was irrational. I don't know about you ladies, but I've been told that. So I had to kind of work with that. It's like, I don't think so. I don't think this is irrational. It might be emotional, but it's not irrational. And so I had to decide, okay, so underneath this umbrella of rationality, maybe there's room for being cognitive in my head and being emotional in my feelings. Okay? And so emotions, it turns out, are actually very rational. Now, that might be puzzling on first sight, but I think what I'm saying is that what the principle here is that there's truth here that I can discover. Bible's a good source. Experience is a good source. The natural world is a good source. It's going to be fun. I just like do a face plant. But then there's also truth over here. So, and what I mean by that is, what I'm not saying is that if I have a feeling, it's true. Because I think we can feel that way about our feelings a lot of times. It just feels so true. So that's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that my feelings can point me to something true. And the way they do that is by helping me understand what my emotional beliefs are. So if I have a response that's in my emotions, that I respond a particular way, then it raises the question, where does that come from? How come I respond that way? And it raises the question for me then, what do I believe? And it isn't what do I believe about what the Bible has to say. It's what do I believe about the fact that I was scared to death that my mother was going to hurt herself, and that every relationship since then is based on never disappointing someone. Because you don't disappoint people in relationships, they might get hurt. So that's an emotional belief. And I don't know that belief until I'm in a relationship that confronts me with it, and I get freaked out when I disappoint somebody. And then I have the process then of learning what's really true about reality. And then I have the opportunity to compare that to reality. So what I then compare that to is, I check it out. I talk to them. You know, I might even say, with somebody I trust, I'd say, I am so freaked out that I disappointed you. And I've done this. It was incredibly revelational to me for someone to say, yeah? So? Of course you disappointed me. What else is new? I mean, we disappoint each other. You know, it's not that... it's a big deal, and we got to work with it, and we got to learn how to love each other, and we don't do that well, and it's always something we're going to be working with. But sever the friendship because you disappointed me? You know? And that was huge for me, because my fear about that was the truth. In other words, it revealed my belief to me. It was a belief that I had that when it comes down to truth, actually wasn't true. Okay? So it helped take me toward truth, to be willing to understand that and feel it and know what that meant. So that's what I mean by emotional truth. And so feelings are a great source for learning what we believe on an emotional level, and then comparing that with what the world looks like and what's true.
You were talking about, intellectually, when you went into school and got into biology and became an intellectual. And I'm looking at this kind of emotional feeling of truth, and I'm kind of wondering, do you also think that some of the reasons why you went to atheism is because you felt like maybe you had disappointed God, or that...
No. He disappointed me. Yeah, that's a good question, though. That's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. Oh, right. He asked if, see if I got it, if part of my turning to atheism was out of feeling like I had disappointed God. Right, right. I don't think so, and that's really telling, because that's how much I thought I was getting it right. I'm not proud of that. but I think that that was true. I really felt, I mean, looking back on it now, again, I couldn't have said this at the time at all. I had no awareness of that layer. Like I said, when my mother said what she did, it was like, you were so wrong. But I think that in having developed this view of God that was definitely a quid pro quo, which means you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. we got a deal. And everything in my Christianity up to that point had reinforced that, quite honestly. The Christian culture that I was in and where I had gone with Christianity, it reinforced it. If you do your quiet time, you're going to grow spiritually. If you study the Bible, God's going to bless you. If you worship well, God's going to make your life wonderful. You're going to have victory. I mean, it's reinforced over and over and over and over, and I was set up for it big time. It worked perfectly with what I came into it with from before Christianity.
I have two questions. The first is it's sort of similar to Bond's question about sort of where have you come in your views.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm more interested in how your views have changed in regards to politics.
Okay. I have been all over the spectrum on the political questions. Now, when I was sneaking into churches because I didn't think they liked me, I was a very liberal Democrat and, voted for Mondale. Yeah. yeah, Dukakis too. and then after I became a Christian again, I began rethinking a lot of my positions politically, and a big one was pro-life for me because I was very pro-choice in my atheist days, and it became very important to me to rethink that, I felt like, because I really still struggle with this one a bit, I have to say, because it gets so polarized, you know, that. But at that time, the way I would have asked the question is, what's pro-life about starting wars? You know, if you're going to protect unborn babies, why don't we protect all those people at that time in Nicaragua who were being killed by American bullets? That seemed really inconsistent to me. And so, as I went on, I just started rethinking kind of what I really thought about. I would not have been for limiting abortions on any level legally. And then I gradually shifted into understanding that, kind of a different understanding of what our legal process does and what it allows for. Kind of it's like a shift between, there's a difference between decriminalizing something and making it legal. So making it legal says it's a good choice. Says it's, you know, valid, great, go for it. And I can't say that about the choice to have an abortion. I don't think it's a good thing. People do it, and people will do it, and I think on some level it should be safe for them to do it. But I think there's other ways to do that. So anyway, but what I'm going to say is I've been all over the spectrum politically, and I would have to say that I hang around the middle anymore. I've been very libertarian also, and I have to say I've never really been a true blue conservative way over on the right, but I've definitely, you know, headed that direction. But I change back and forth, and I think the same thing, it's like, yeah, I don't know what I'm going to say, but I hover around the center these days. And sometimes I'm right of center, and sometimes I'm a little left of center, but I'm usually around the center.
Okay, my second question is...
now I've said that on tape.
is on the board...
Registered here. Independent.
On the board behind you, you have this art of rationality. Mm-hmm. Beneath it is cognitive and emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And shouldn't... maybe this is ridiculous, but isn't irrationality part of that? Emotional feelings that are irrational or cognitive ideas that are irrational?
Mm-hmm. I think we can entertain them, but I don't think they work. I mean, I don't think that we can live there for very long.
But I mean, find truth in them.
Help me understand what you mean. Julian's asking for the tape. I forgot. I haven't been doing that very well. Julian's asking how you think about learning from the irrational. Is that kind of it? Okay. So how are you just understanding irrational?
Your feeling. You have failed. It's a feeling that you understand, but it's a God or reality.
Yeah, my feelings point me to an irrational concept of God, or is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let me clarify something. Maybe this will help. We use the word irrational in a lot of different ways, and so I think we can use irrational, even though you know. The woman in me recoils a bit. But in our vernacular, that's one of the words that we use, you know? And it works. It's like, because, you know, how many of us have never been irrational, you know? Anybody? I noticed the men didn't. Oh, look, the man saying, oh, you weren't saying that.
I wonder if. Like your comment about God, can God make a rock too big for him to lift?
Right.
If you attach the word God to a sentence that's nonsense, just putting the word God in there doesn't make the sentence make sense. It's nonsense with God and with all other things.
Right.
Meanings.
Right.
So isn't non-rational? I mean, we are rational.
Right.
So
right.
If we have thoughts that are things that aren't real or are untrue, those are irrational thoughts.
Right. And that's the distinction I'm trying to get at. I think you've said it well. Because the way I'm using this word is like untenable. You know, it doesn't work. It's like this is not here and not here at the same time. I can't run out into the street and both be hit by a car and not be hit by the car. One or the other is going to happen if there's a car coming. And so that's the way I'm using this word, and that's why I asked you, Julian, to kind of clarify that, because I think we can use the word that way. We can use non-rational in this way as well. But you're saying that non-rational might fit better for up here. Is that kind of what you're saying in a way?
Well, some things...
But
inherently contradictory, intrinsically contradictory,
right.
Then it's non-rational.
Right, exactly. When it breaks the law of non-contradiction, yeah. Then that's what I was limiting my use of the word irrational to that. And so that's why in our vernacular, sure, we use words like, you know, irrational and a lot of other ones too that can be confusing. But that's part of why I'm drawing this picture this way, because this is rationality. It's like this umbrella that I think covers the whole of creation. And so we're going to learn from non-cognitive things. We're going to learn from mystery. We're going to learn from our emotions. We're going to learn from our experience. But fundamentally, all of those things have in common that they make sense. And even when you say, you know, I'm learning from a feeling, the reason I can learn from it is because eventually it makes sense. And when I work with people in my counseling office, a lot of times what we're doing is helping these come together in an integrated way to kind of, okay, this has never made sense to me. Help me make sense out of it. It's like I have to kind of work backwards to get all the way down into these feelings to start making sense out of them. But eventually, the goal is going to be integration of, oh, that's why I've always felt that way. Now, that in itself, now, you know, this is a psychological debate, but, you know, a lot of therapies just stay right with the cognitive and say, well, just do it differently and start feeling differently about it. I haven't found that to be that helpful for people. Why did I start saying that? Oh, just that because fundamentally even understanding the truth is not going to just immediately make everything make sense because I figured out differently. I have to actually go through an emotional process of changing the beliefs. And part of that is involved with taking risks that are contrary to what I believe to be true. Like in the example that I gave when I actually checked it out with my friend. I am so afraid that I just disappointed you and that you're going to reject me. That was really scary to me to say that out loud. That was huge for me to say that out loud. And for her to respond in a way that said, no, I'm still here. Helped me learn something different emotionally because that wasn't something that I could just learn here. I had to learn it in the context of a relationship in which I felt safe and also vulnerable. So... that. We have about 5 more minutes, I think. Any other questions, thoughts, ideas?
This may be similar to what Julian was asking, or you may have just been talking about it and I'm not getting it. But emotional truth is something that I find really hard to swallow. One, because in environments especially like Gutenberg and Libri, feelings can be deceiving. It's thrown around a lot. And I think...
So this is kind of more concentrated on in those environments.
Yeah, that's more concentrated on and the emotions
I see what you're saying.
Are kind of like... Mm-hmm. Be
aware. Yeah. Be wary. Right. Be wary of emotions.
Because 9 times out of 10,
they're deceiving you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's never been a percentage given or anything, but the way it gets thrown around is leaning towards 9 times out of 10, you're being deceived by your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So it's, I don't even think I've ever heard the word emotional truth.
And you heard it here.
So I don't know if you can.
You wanna?
Yeah.
You know, I can't repeat everything.
Okay. Thanks. If we summarize what Nancy was saying, by paying attention to her emotions, she came to understand that they were telling her something false. She could have come to understand that they were telling her something true. But oftentimes in cultures, you either let's go with your emotions, don't be in your head, or emotions, bad. Let's just think. And we miss out. If she had said, oh, those emotions aren't true. I just need to believe that God's in control. I just need to put on this cognitive reframe and run away from the fact that I get flooded and panicked every time I disappoint someone. Don't try to understand where that comes from. Just know that that's not true. The depth of wisdom wouldn't be there. She explored why do I feel that way? Oh, it makes sense that I feel that way because of my childhood. I have generalized it into a worldview. Is that true? No, and I'm going to walk out of understanding, walk out of that understanding into challenging myself to try to experience relationships, try to trust that God's in control of reality versus my ability to do it right. I'm going to take risks to learn that. It's a very different... I'm not being very articulate, but we end up having a shallow wisdom if we're just thinking or we're just feeling. We are created with both those things. And we can understand depths of reality if we explore those. She didn't come to an emotional truth that she didn't say, oh, I feel like if I disappoint people that something horrible is going to happen, therefore it's true. But if she didn't understand where that came from, her ability to challenge it, her ability to have God's worldview challenge it, would be incredibly... there we go, truncated. My vocabulary is escaping me again.
Yeah, I like what Gabe just said. That's right, that we can get stuck in either to our detriment. And so that integration idea that I'm talking about, I think, is really important. It doesn't mean that once I have this experience that I'm never going to feel afraid again when I disappoint somebody either. And I think that's an important clarification, because then my emotional truth that I'm working with is when I have the feeling of fear overtake me, then the truth that I know is I struggle with fear when I disappoint someone. And that's a really good thing for me to know. And that's what's true about me. And partly because of the experiences that God has given me, partly because I'm a sinner who doesn't trust God well, and, you know, partly because some people do leave when you disappoint them. I mean, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that fear to be there, but I no longer have to be controlled by that fear in the way that your friends might be saying, don't listen to your emotions, they're deceiving you. Because if I'm just controlled by that fear, then that's not helpful. But what I'm suggesting is that we can start to let the volume come up a little bit and let us know, and help us know something that's true, and then work with it. And what it might look like is that I continue to really struggle with that fear, but at least I understand it better. I mean, understanding is not nothing. It's like it's helpful for me to know that context for myself, and I can even give myself a little bit more permission when I understand that. It's like, oh, I'm just going to struggle. And then I can decide where I'm going to risk in relationships and where I'm going to find people that can care about me there and just be with that. Or I can make a request that that somebody be sensitive about that with me in a, you know, I'm not going to pass out a menu for a lot of people, but in a very close, you know, in certain key relationships, I think that can be something that we give to each other, is sensitivity to those things. So, but if we don't know those, you know, if we don't know what's going on there, then we're just going to be kind of bumping into each other everywhere with it. So, Deb?
I appreciate a lot of these thoughts right now. affirm your question, and I certainly, I would say that's the place that I come from, and yet it's this issue of the cognitive. In some circles, the cognitive is given so much more weight, and yet, as Nancy's also shared, which I think a lot of us can relate to in other Christian circles, the emotional is given no weight, and the cognitive is thrown out. And in some ways, a lot of this discussion is pretty new to me, so I feel very much in process on it. But I think one other side of it is that I do ask, on what basis do we actually trust that our cognitive sense is more reliable? Why do we trust ourselves cognitively? On what grounds does somehow the intellectual or cognitive world, why does that seem more plausible or more grounded? Then, yes, as you exactly say, we're told to distrust our emotions. But why trust our brains? And I don't mean to separate those. So,
I just think it's because it's easy to categorize your rationality.
Yeah, it fits into boxes a little bit better. But it's a great question. It's like, you know, and it kind of comes back to what Earl was saying last time, is we don't know a lot. And we're going to be struggling. We're going to be putting things together along the way, and we're going to be changing our minds a lot. And it's a process. Life is a process. Yeah. We're over time. So if you want to talk more.